I'm thinking Janet Yellen doesn't drive her own car anymore, but you better believe she knows how much gas costs. Macroeconomics in price per gallon on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, it is the 21st of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. I'm going to throw a couple of numbers at you to start things off today. Nice and easy, of course, because numbers make for tricky radio. But these are numbers that leave big macroeconomic ripples in their wake. All right, so here we go. The first one is $34.74. That's oil denominated in the price per gallon at the close today in New York. The second is directly related, $1.99. That's gas in price per gallon, according to AAA. Pump prices right now are the lowest they've been since the deepest parts of the Great Recession, a windfall that has saved Americans $115 billion all told. That's $550 for every licensed driver in the land. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going with that story today.
AAA says gas is about 40 cents a gallon cheaper today than 1 year ago. So I asked around as I was picking up my morning coffee what folks are doing with the money they're saving. Jimmy Gutschwager was pressure washing pavements outside the grocery store.
I mean, I spend a little bit more expenditures like going out to dinner or just things I might look at and go, no, I won't do it. I might be more opt to doing it with the gas staying lower.
But here's the thing. This gas pump windfall hasn't translated into a consumer spending windfall nationwide. Some of the gas savings are going into a higher savings rate, people putting money in the bank and retirement accounts or paying down debt. And how people treat their gas savings depends a lot on income level, says Santa Clara University finance professor Meyer Statman.
For people with higher incomes, even $500 over a year, that really is not something that they necessarily notice.
People who live paycheck to paycheck definitely notice the savings, says Statman, and then spend it right away on other necessities that are rising in cost, like rent, medical care, and car insurance. And for the broad middle class, says consumer psychologist Kit Yarrow at Golden Gate University,
it's a little extra spending money, but it's not really changing their budgets as much as you would think it might.
One thing Americans are spending more on, though, as gas prices fall, their gas-guzzling rides. This year, SUV and pickup truck sales have risen by double digits. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you're one of those who thinks politics here is interesting right now, let me direct your attention for a second overseas for some more of the same. Spaniards went to the polls yesterday and couldn't quite make up their collective minds. The conservative and incumbent People's Party won the most votes, but not enough to control the parliament. And in fact, the result was so fractured, it's not at all clear how they're going to come up with a governing coalition. Not so promising for a key European economy still working its way out of recession and controversy. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains.
Spain enacted tough austerity measures after the economic crisis, and now the country is starting to grow again at about 3%. But...
well, it's still a pretty bad recession to most people in Spain.
Mark Weisbrod is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. There's still really high unemployment. Almost 50% of young Spaniards don't have jobs.
I think people were not convinced that the austerity actually worked, and I think there's very good economic reasons for them not to believe that.
And there's not so much fear nowadays that problems in Spain's economy will harm Europe overall. Brian Lawson is an economic consultant for IHS in Spain.
There has been an unlimited backstop from the European Central Bank, which has prevented the risk of economic and financial meltdown.
But Spaniards aren't the only European voters tiring of austerity measures. Voters in Greece and Portugal have also pushed pro-austerity parties from leadership. Desmond Lockman is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He says yesterday's election is evidence of that discontent.
The Spanish economy was beginning to grow. It was beginning to show signs of healing. But if we now have a period of political uncertainty, political instability, that's the last thing that Spain needs.
Lockman says if the parties can't form a coalition, Spanish voters may have to head back to the polls in a few months. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down, then up, then down, then up again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The business model for higher education in this country is a little bit shaky. Schools are getting pushback about tuition increases. At the same time, they've got expensive campuses to run and tenured faculty to pay, not to mention all kinds of questions being raised about whether college is even worth the debt you pile up in the process. All of that goes double for small private colleges. Moody's, the ratings company, predicts the rate of small college closings is going to triple in the next few years. Our education correspondent Amy Scott went up to Vermont to see how one tiny college is fighting the good fight.
The first thing I notice about Marlborough College, the 6-foot-high wooden poles sticking out of the ground lining the walkways, an ominous sign of the coming winter, it turns out. They're guides for the snow plows.
Which makes me think there must be a lot of snow here.
That's absolutely accurate. 100% accurate.
Yeah, I didn't even know what a proper winter jacket was until I came here.
Those are my tour guides, sophomores Alessandro Pane from Maine and Alex Quick from Pennsylvania. Marlborough was founded in 1946 on an old farm. It was built to be a different kind of college where students direct their own learning. Pane says there are no course requirements or majors. Students spend their junior and senior years on a self-designed independent study.
It can make it a very intense environment. We've got this very small community that's very close with all people who are like very invested in what they're doing. This is not a college for everybody.
Marlborough is meant to be small, ideally 250 to 300 students. But this year, there are only 182.
Yeah. Ouch.
Bridget Lawler is the dean of admissions. Because the school gives out so much financial aid, the average student pays about half the $50,000 sticker price. But when Lawler asked accepted students why they didn't come, many said they still couldn't afford it.
Or they chose not to come because they felt like there wasn't enough critical mass. It just felt too small. And so to change that, we had to do something that was audacious.
What they came up with was the Renaissance Scholars Program. Next fall, Marlborough hopes to bring in 52 new students on full scholarships, one from every state, plus D.C. and Puerto Rico.
The choice the trustees had was either just let things continue to go as they're going or invest in this Renaissance program.
Phil Steckler is one of those trustees. He says to pay for that investment, the board decided to do what's become almost unthinkable in higher education.
We're going to dive into our endowment to the tune of, you know, probably $8 to $10 million over the next 4 or 5 years.
The idea is to bring in enough new students that the college will become more appealing and attract future students who can afford to pay. If it works, the scholarship program could be expanded to other countries.
I think it's an expensive move.
Jeff Dineen is a higher education consultant with Bain & Company. He says Marlborough is lucky. Its $40 million endowment is rare for small colleges, but it faces the same pressures, high costs, and the perception that liberal arts degrees aren't marketable.
If I were them, I think I'd be looking more at, you know, first of all, how do we do a better job of retaining the students that we have? And secondly, I'd look at how do we make sure that we are really delivering what students value.
The college is working on retention and rethinking the curriculum. It's also teamed up with other colleges to offer more courses and internship opportunities. John Sheehy has taught writing and literature at Marlborough for 17 years.
The faculty right now are really mobilized to make necessary changes in Marlborough that will make us a better college.
The students are too.
Welcome to town meeting. Thank you for being here. Pretty good turnout this week.
Another unique thing about Marlborough, it's town meetings, where students, staff, and faculty vote on proposals to, say, revise the sexual misconduct policy or extend the hours of the coffee shop. Today, a professor stands before a large map of the country, taking volunteers to recruit new students for the Renaissance program.
Helen, Massachusetts. Connor, Ohio.
Sophomore Helen Pinch adopts Massachusetts. She says Marlboro has been on the brink before.
There's some legendary stories about like professors working for no pay and like students doing all the maintenance work on campus, just like scraping by. You know, living on the edges kind of seems to be in the Marlboro's tradition.
That's one tradition the school wouldn't mind learning to live without. In Marlboro, Vermont, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Funny thing happened on the way to cleaning up the world's most popular sport today. Sepp Blatter, who happens to be the president of FIFA, soccer's world governing body, was banned from the sport for 8 years by the FIFA Ethics Commission. Didn't come as a huge surprise. Corruption investigations have been going on for a year or more. Indictments have been handed down, and corporations have threatened to pull their millions in sponsorship dollars. Johnson & Johnson, in fact, already has. Visa, Adidas, and Coca-Cola, to name just a couple, have said they are thinking about their long-term relationship with FIFA. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more.
FIFA is projected to run a deficit of almost $100 million this year. The last time it lost money? 2001. Roger Pilkey Jr. teaches sports governance at the University of Colorado.
The fact that FIFA lost money indicates that actually the actions of the sponsors are having an effect and are compelling the organization, kicking and screaming, to move its governance into the 21st century.
And it's not cheap to put together events like the World Cup. FIFA spent close to $2 billion to put on the tournament in Brazil last summer. Susan McPherson is a marketing consultant.
They need that money.
Last year, Sony and Emirates didn't renew their FIFA partnerships, but all told, McPherson says FIFA's lucky.
Given some of the scandals that have happened in the past year, they're fortunate that the likes of Coca-Cola and McDonald's and Hyundai and Nike are still on board.
One reason? You're probably not going to DVR the World Cup final like you would the Big Bang Theory. Scott Galloway teaches marketing at NYU.
In a digital age, it's very hard to find scale. The temptation to get in front of a billion eyeballs is just too great.
It's unlikely all of FIFA's sponsors are going to pull out and demand reorganization. Thomas Ordahl is a chief strategy officer at Landor. He thinks we'll continue to see more transparency between sponsors and the organizations they're supporting because that's what consumers expect.
Part of that, people are expecting sponsors to be more aware of the businesses and the practices of the businesses they're sponsoring.
FIFA still has a little while to ink in all of its advertisers for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. But at last count, half of the major sponsor slots are still open. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in leisure and entertainment, Adele's going on tour next year, as you might have heard. Tickets for her North American concerts went on sale last week. And while a relative handful, compared to demand, did get lucky, others, most, tell nightmarish tales of waiting in line only to be told shows were sold out. That will no doubt send droves of fans to the resale ticket market, which is exactly what Adele's camp has said it tried to avoid. Gigi Dubin has that story.
At exactly 10 a.m., the day Adele tickets went on sale, Samantha Constable, a personal assistant in Sunnyvale, California, pounced. Time went on and on and on. No tickets.
I went and got eyelash extensions. I was still logged in. I made dinner and I was still logged in.
12 hours later, with two browsers open on Ticketmaster's website, Constable gave up. Tickets on resale sites like StubHub were soon listing for as much as several $1,000s a pop. For Adele.
I like her, but I have the luxury of having a British passport. I can go back to England anytime.
Adele partnered with a company called Songkick to try to keep tickets off the secondary market. The company says it worked in Europe, where Adele sold more than 165,000 tickets, 40% of the total, through her website, Adele.com. But in the U.S., where Ticketmaster is so dominant, she sold a much smaller percentage. And this is Adele, so tickets were scarce.
And whether those are sold through scalpers or whether they're sold through Songkick doesn't really matter. There's just more people who want to go than there are seats.
That's Victor Bennett, who studies the ticket resale market at Duke University's business school. He says scarcity is just one source of frustration.
The other one is the buying experience. And it's actually really hard to run a ticket exchange.
So even with the best technology, Bennett says putting something on sale and having millions flock to your website within seconds is going to leave a lot of people unhappy. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not like it used to be when we were growing up, you know, business. It's a lot to worry about.
How the economy feels away from all the headlines. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 123 points this Monday, 0.7%, closed at 17,251. The NASDAQ up 45 points, 0.9%, 49.68. The S&P 500 grew 15 points, 0.75%. 2021 there. As we mentioned earlier, the average gas price dipped below $2 a gallon, so the energy sector is idling, one might say. Royal Dutch Shell sputtered 0.2%. Chevron drained 0.6% today. If you haven't seen the latest Star Wars flick, we will not spoil it for you other than to say awesome. Let us just say, though, wasn't much awakening for big theater chains today. Regal Entertainment lost 1.5%. I get paid for this. AMC Entertainment gave back 2.5% today. Walt Disney, by the way, and go figure this one out, off 1% today, whatever. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.19%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A good economy, which is what the headline numbers tell us we have, sometimes doesn't feel so good. A lot of people feel like they're just getting by, even when they've got what look to be pretty good jobs. Our election year series, My Economy, is all about that, about what happens when you zoom in from the economic big picture, the numbers and the data sets that we talk about all the time, to the way things feel to people who are actually living them, to you.
The life and the kind of job that I want.
Prosperity.
Providing for your children.
My head above water.
My economy.
My economy.
My economy.
Memphis, Tennessee is where the story takes us today, because once you land at the airport there, you are smack dab in the middle of the global economy, in among the people who make it work. Late in the evening, around 10 or 11 o'clock at night, the giant FedEx facility in the northeast corner of the airport starts to get real, real busy.
So this system that you're looking at is rated at 6,000 packages every 2 minutes, and our normal night is 550,000 packages through this sort. As we move forward to the next few weeks, we will process 800,000, 900,000, pushing 1 million packages through this sort each night.
Marcus Martinez helps run what's called the FedEx World Hub. Pretty much any FedEx package that is sent from or is going to someplace outside the United States comes through here.
It's the busiest airport in the world after dark. It's also the heaviest airport in the world in terms of cargo tonnage handled on an annual basis.
And this time of year, it is, let me tell you, closely controlled chaos.
There's about 10,000 people going to be on property tonight. About 7,200 of those are package interface frontline employees.
Package interface. All the boxes and more boxes that you and I and everybody else in this economy are shipping all over the place.
They're coming out of a container, unload right. Up a belt, right. And then that employee in that pod is basically balancing the flow across these individuals.
So that guy is controlling these little arms.
Correct. We're going to do this essentially up here about 3 hours solid a night. This time of year, it's going to be a little bit more.
Takes a lot of people to do that, most of them working overnight, most of them part-time. They do get benefits and health care. There's a tuition reimbursement program that's real popular, but they are not full-time jobs. Some people, like Camilla Johnson, who's studying to be a nurse, work 25 hours a week or so and go to school the rest of the time.
We unload freight and we build up freight to go to the outbound. So it's a lot of forklift driving and it's a lot of tug driving. So it's really fast-paced.
How are you getting by? When do you sleep? When do you...
I sleep like 2 hours, get up, go to school, then I sleep another 2 hours, and then I come to work.
You know that's not, you're going to be a nurse. You know that's not healthy, right?
Yeah, I know. You know, I have been doing it for a while, so my time, I know how to manage my time that, you know, for it, so it can work for me.
Okay, so you're in school. Mm-hmm. You have an almost full-time job.
How do things feel, right? Do you feel good? How do you feel?
I mean, I feel good. I get the hours that I need to, you know, to live. So, yeah, I mean, I feel good.
Others, though, like Robert Lee, this is the only job he's got. And I asked him the same question I asked Camilla.
Well, like all Americans, you know, it's a struggle. But since I've been here, I mean, it's gotten better.
Do you have enough money to, if you needed a new car, could you buy a new car? If you want to go on vacation, could you do that?
Not right now.
No?
Not at this moment. I have to save up a little bit.
How much are you able to save? I mean, are you living paycheck to paycheck?
Basically, yes. Like I said, I've gotten a little bit advanced, so, you know, I've gotten a few raises. So, you know, I'm doing a little better.
You feeling good or you're not feeling good?
I'm good.
You can get why somebody working part-time feels like he's just getting by, but it can feel that way even if you've got a good full-time job as well. Up a ways from the offloading of those planes, way up, actually, with dark red lighting and radar screens, is the control tower, where Elisa Sanabria spends her nights tracking and talking to FedEx planes inbound to the Memphis airport.
I've been in the tower for 10 years with the company for 20.
How does your economy right now feel to you?
My personal economy? On the upswing. But I feel that it's because of our hard work and discipline. And it's on the upswing. So I feel pretty good about it, actually.
On the upswing from where?
From having 2 children in 2 years, moving into a larger house, career changes, you know, personal family issues, the various things that happen to everybody's family, you know. But I don't know, maybe with age comes wisdom, and hopefully it's finally kicking in.
How much longer are you going to do this?
I don't know. It's hard. That's hard to say with 2 small children at home.
How old are your kids?
6 and 4. It's hard. I want to say I love what I do, but at the same time, home is calling.
I understand you probably don't want to answer this question with your boss's boss standing right there. How much is FedEx paying you to do this job in the middle of the night?
They pay me enough, but more would be better.
You work all night, you get hungry. We did, a lot of people do. Bryant's Breakfast came with a strong recommendation. It's a diner, bright yellow and busy inside, with a line that was never less than 20 people long the hour we spent there. But the line does move real fast. Carrie Burton runs the place with her brother.
I've been working in the restaurant since I was 10 years old.
And your dad owned this place?
Yes. And we all worked in the restaurant.
How's business?
It's okay.
How does it feel out there when you go to put gas in the car and make your house payments?
Mm-hmm. Hard. Hard. Everything is hard. Making payments, making, you know, yeah, everything is hard.
Why do you think that is?
It's not like it used to be when we were growing up, you know, business. Yeah. It's hard work. It's a lot to worry about. I mean, I love it, but it's still, you go home with it every day.
Does it stress you out?
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does stress me out.
Do you lose sleep?
No, I don't lose sleep. I just have a cocktail. Glass of red wine helps it every time. Probably a lot of people's jobs do that, you know? But red wine's good for you, so. That's where y'all are from, California?
Yes, ma'am.
We have to help y'all with your economy, too, in California.
Yes, ma'am, that's true.
Yeah.
There was something I kept hearing from Carrie Burton and all those people at FedEx, too, that was pretty interesting. That although they do feel like they're just getting by, there is economic optimism out there, too, a sense that if they work hard, they're going to do all right. We saw that in the poll we did this fall as well, and we're going to keep on looking for it as we report on the state of the economy leading up to the election next year, figuring out how things feel to the people who are living them. We've got a whole bunch of extras on our website about this, pictures, video, and, as I said, our National Economic Survey, the Marketplace Edison Research Poll. While you're there, we hope you'll tell us a bit about your economy and how it feels, and let us know where you think we ought to go next.
This final note on the way out today, about which I kind of don't know how I feel, honestly. The baby name site Nameberry came out with its list of top baby names for 2015 today. Lachlan is number 3 for boys. Austin is number 2. You know where this is going, right? Yes, Kai came in on top. Two things, though, about that. First of all, baby name sites? I don't know. But second of all, and more importantly, and from the marketplace desk of Get Over Yourself, the Social Security Administration is pretty much the baby name database of record in this country. They had me listed at 177th place as of 2014. So, you know, that. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 123 points today, about 0.7%. The NASDAQ up 45 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 grew 15 points, 0.75%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. .177, that's a little harsh, right?
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.